Because you're jumping back into the gap. I let the coach, it's either sideline, two on the side, three on the side. That's off the second cut. Lead the country in offensive rebound.
Hey, coach. Welcome to the Basketball Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Oliver. Let's share the game. Looking for a gift for a coach who loves basketball coaching? Get them a membership to basketballimmersion.com so they can join thousands of coaches who are stimulating their coaching with a world-leading platform for basketball coach education. Go to basketballimmersion.com/sign-up to get them a gift during this special time of year. Coach, it's awesome today to have Craig Doty here from Imperial State University. And Coach, welcome to the podcast. Just tremendous to have you here, and thanks for sharing the game.
Chris, I appreciate the opportunity to be here and talk to you guys the day after Thanksgiving, and I look forward to having a great conversation.
Three-time national championship head coach. Let's get that out of the way first. Great success in your career. But I wanted to start with your Twitter bio, and I don't usually read out bios, but I just wanted to start with this because it's going to lead us into a conversation. Your Twitter bio says, head men's basketball coach, NCAA Division II at the MIAA, three-time national champion head coach at Midwest Elite BB, co-founder, and then your hashtag Stingers Up and Team MEB. Coach, so many people who follow me say something just like, it just says basketball coach. And then as we talked about a little bit off air, you have to do a little bit of research. And honestly, as someone who has a lot of people who follow them, I love to follow people back, but sometimes I don't know who they are. What inspired you to dig into this social media and really present a tremendous online image?
Well, you're exactly right on yourself, Chris, in regards to the mystery that surrounds you. Who is this Chris Oliver with B-Ball Immersion who's presenting all these incredible stats that everybody's taking from around the country and putting it on a digital platform such as Twitter for us all to educate ourselves, learn. And we've had today, my coaching friends, we've all dug into you just because of the amount of information that you've shared. And I make mine a little more readily available. I guess there's not one approach that's better than the other. In spelling my Twitter bio, for me, it's important to try to get to share the game as much as I possibly can, to give out information that's valuable to other people. 90% of what I try to post is information that either surrounds my current men's basketball program at Emporia State or coaching education bits, which are primarily geared towards high school coaches. And coaches who are on the up and coming, who want information, basically information maybe I wish I would have had back when I was starting, that I try to make readily available through Twitter. And, you know, it's great to have a good following. I try to follow back as many people as I possibly can as well. And the platform has been good for both you and me, Chris.
It's been tremendous. And encourage coaches, first off, to check your bio. And I think more coaches should follow that where there's no research needed. Now, mine is essentially a 12-second pitch where it's trying to explain what I do. And then obviously to be able to draw them to the website. And it's sort of, you know, the intended goal is that obviously you go check out the website or you go check out the podcast. But the idea is the 12-second pitch. In this short bio, you can tell who you are and what you do. And, you know, I encourage coaches to check that out. But that's great to get behind your motivation behind social media sharing as well, Coach. And you talk a lot in lists. And my question to you is this a similar way that you talk to your players? Do you share lists with them in terms of trying to communicate what your program and what your culture is all about?
You know, I think we do it completely different in terms of communicating face-to-face with our guys versus trying to put something together in a limited number of characters on Twitter. We list it just to keep it clean, just so those who are following can see the list. They can identify, you know, I have an English degree. I hope I've learned how to master reading, writing, listening, and speaking. And my wife says I'm really good at all those besides listening. So I guess I'm still a work in progress on that side. But when it comes to writing, I've always wrote in paragraphs because that's what I've done throughout my education. But from a formatting standpoint, I just think Twitter is easier where you can expand, but you can you can put lists out there and make them even open to comprehension a little bit. Whereas if we, you know, when I'm talking with our student athletes at Emporia State University, we try to create dialogue. We try to create back and forth, specifically in meeting settings where we know when we talk, there's gray area. You know, why is this taking place? Why are we not crashing glass here? These are our defaults and our foundations we're teaching by. But sometimes we're not just speaking in to hear ourselves talk. We actually want a response from our student athletes in terms of why certain things are taking place in the court. And ultimately that comes back to building culture. So we don't talk in lists with our guys, but however, we do try to open up dialogue and have back and forth.
And one of the things, again, I talked to you a little bit briefly off air about is the problem with a list. And your answer is what I suspected. Because the problem is when you talk in a list, you inevitably like leave out certain things and you leave out certain context to things. And I see these lists all the time on Twitter. For example, one of yours, why players succeed, tough, smart, great work ethic, or great teammate, love the game. All those things are amazing and all those things are true. But player success generally starts with becoming the most skilled basketball player you can be. I think sometimes we do a disservice to players when we tell them, you know, it's about effort, it's about commitment. You know what it is? It's about getting as skilled as possible. And all those other things can eliminate you. But you're not even in the conversation if you aren't skilled as a basketball player.
Yeah, I've had some good experiences. When I was at Central Wyoming College, a junior college in Riverton, Wyoming, I went out there as a coach under Jamie Stevens, and he had five international players. And we look at it from two different standpoints because we brought in some kids that came in. For instance, we had a Serbian who was one of the most skilled kids we had ever been around. And there were some other kids that were just highly skilled, but just the skills alone, without the toughness, without being able to handle physicality, without being able to adapt to the culture of where they were playing in America, you know, without the intangibles, the skills weren't as relevant because they weren't tough enough to put on the floor. You know, at the same time, too, sometimes you have an unskilled player that's just tough as nails, that can rebound, that can defend, doesn't provide much. You almost have to hide them offensively. I think, and usually where I coach and speak from, Chris, is from a perspective of there being some gray area and also being as much of a hybrid player as you can, that you're not just skilled and you're not just tough, but you're a little bit of everything. And having that player balance is really important. Going back to the list, of course, yes, we putting things down such as being tough and being coachable. These are just things potentially where a high school athlete or even a junior high athlete in middle school can look at it and kind of check boxes off for themselves in terms of the tweets and say, well, I'm really good at this. That's awesome. Okay, I need to work at this. And then they can kind of try to build their comprehensive image and comprehensive plan moving forward on how they're going to best succeed.
Love it. And one of my favorites that I saw on yours is this emphasis that we help our players get ready to play and prepared for. And then it's interviews, career success, date night, weddings, business dinners, ceremonies. Can you talk about some of the things that you do to prepare your players for those things? Because I love seeing that, and I know that that's not just words in your program.
Absolutely. In basketball, we talk about their guys all the time. I mean, basketball in itself is almost fake. I mean, if you look at it, if you take all the life lessons and the emotions out of it, you're looking at a basketball. You're looking at a ball that has air in it that goes through a hoop. And if you take all the life lessons that you can learn along the way out of it, it's really a silly game. You bounce a ball, you run up and down, and you put it through a hoop. But then you look at competitiveness, you look at teamwork, you look at punctuality, you look at showing up, you know, all the things that go into becoming a successful basketball player and ultimately a successful basketball team and program. Those are the exact same things oftentimes. They parallel that being successful in your community, being successful as a father or a mother, being successful as a professional in an industry outside of sport. And that's what makes this game so powerful. Performing under pressure, being able to perform in front of an audience, being able to present. These are all things that go hand in hand to having life success outside of the game. And we push that upon our guys all the time. handling adversity, being patient. How many times are talented kids not getting on the floor because they're just not quite ready, but yet they have to be patient? You don't get to be the CEO until you've done your time and worked your way up. Oftentimes, some people are ahead of the eight ball, but you know, these are all life lessons that are taught through the game of basketball. And I think it's the responsibility of every coach in the world who has an opportunity to teach through the game, through any sports, to be able to connect the dots for their players so they can see the parallels to real life.
Coach, great stuff. And obviously all this has led to success on the court as well, which is the double win situation. You're developing players off the court and on the court, and that's tremendous. But the one thing I wanted to focus on just quickly with you is your teams are an unprecedented 29-5 in the postseason. That's a great, incredible record. And I wanted to dive into a little bit of the why. Beyond the obvious, having great players and talented players, what are some of the things that have led to that great play at the most important time of the year?
It's a great question, Chris. So we talk about it with our staff all the time. We talk about it with our administration and even our players of why we think we have success and we're playing our best basketball late in the year. And I think it all starts with, you know, when we build the program, it's about 80% the coaches and the staff's program and 20% the players' program. And as the season progresses, we give bits and pieces of it to our players. And by the end of the year, that's reversed. It's about 80% the players' program and 20% the coaches' program. And I always feel a player-led program is going to be able to reach its maximum success. I do think the foundations that coaches have to put into it, so we're not just playing open gym, so we have structure, so we're putting our players in strength positions so we can develop our mode of operation in terms of who we're going to be and who we've built the program around and what strengths, whether those be rebounding. Each team can be a little bit different in terms of what your identity is going to be, pace of play, toughness. You know, are we going to be a defensive team that slows tempo down, is going to look more like Tony Bennett's Virginia? Are we going to look more like the Golden State Warriors? And try, you know, back when they were doing well, up until this year when they're increasing number of possessions to try to get as many offensive opportunities as possible. I think the coaches get to establish what the identity is, but they have to then get the players to buy in, and then they have to give it away. They have to give the program to the players. One of the ways we do that, Chris, is through constant film study. We watch every one of our game tapes from front to back. I think it's really important not to just clip it out when you're watching your own team. Now, we clip for our scouting reports constantly, but when we're watching our own games, which we watch every single possession, usually multiple times because we stop and we rewatch every possession. But I think knowing chronological order, what a good shot 4 minutes into the game may be, that may not be a good shot with 4 minutes left in the game when you're up seven. So understanding when the play is taking place, the flow of it, rewatching it, reliving it all over again. We do this every single game. And then by halfway through the season, three quarters of the way through the season, our guys just get a feel through this constant dialogue and watching themselves and reaffirming what happened, what needs to happen next time, that there's a complete buy-in to it. And playing time reflects that too. So they see that, you know, if they're doing the right thing, wins are coming. They're playing more. They're having more individual and team success. And then things just seem to click down the line. So we constantly emphasize film study. And then the other thing, Chris, is how competitive we are in practice. We stat all of our practices. We make every practice matter. When each of our student athletes are done with practice, they get an email into their phone that says what their practice stats were for the day, the whole team's box score of, you know, how many made shots they had out of how many attempts, how many made from behind the arc versus how many attempts, rebounds, assists, turnovers, how many wins they had in drills versus how many losses. They get all of this data from an individual practice standpoint, plus the cumulative throughout the whole year. So they can see this data and they understand where they're at. So every day they show up to practice, it matters what they do. And again, we get this competitive nature flowing. And then when the ball's jumped up, they understand that everything matters again. But they're also used to that because that's how they live every single day.
We're going to get into that because I want to dive deeper into the competitive practice and then even the way that you do that. Talking about this player-led program, then you talked about obviously film study with your team and emphasizing and connecting the ideas that are leading to success. Is that done on an individual basis? Is it done in a group setting? How is this done best within your program?
It's done as an entire team. We have everybody in there, whether you're active and playing and starting, whether you're coming off the bench, whether you're non-rotation or you didn't get in, or even if you're at the college level, you know, we can redshirt. Even if you're a redshirt, you're in there too watching. And we are very frank with our guys. I mean, we call out every single action and we're not afraid to call guys out. You know, we're also not afraid to call ourselves out as coaches. And so, you know what, that was really a bad play decision by me as a coach, or I didn't put you guys in a good enough position here. So again, we're about as frank as possible. Our film room isn't for those who are soft in terms of internalizing things, because we're going to tell you when you're good enough. We're going to tell you when you're making game winning plays and things that are helping us. We're also going to tell you when, and not just tell you, but we're going to show you. Then we're going to rewind. We're going to watch it again. We're going to show you where you're hurting our team and why that can't continue to happen. Then we continue to make lists throughout that, and we build our practice plans around our weaknesses so we can work on aging up in the post. That's a big thing for us right now. Some of our post players are getting called with their hands down as they dig back, and that's a point of emphasis in American college basketball right now. So we do a whole station. We work 10 minutes just on making sure our guys are in an H-up position getting catches. Maybe we're not flat hedging ball screens as good as we need to. We'll then go run stations specifically towards that weakness. So it's no longer a weakness. We can show the guys. We can tell why it needs to be better. We as a coaching staff can take responsibility for the action. And then we can reteach, reemphasize it to make sure it gets fixed.
So when you're talking about honesty in film, this comes up a lot. A lot of people ask me questions about this. In general, being honest, because we know as a coach, being honest is the best way. But what are some coping strategies, if you've used any, for helping your players handle that honesty, especially for new players in your program? Because again, I mean, a lot of players, their initial reaction to coaching is that it's negative and it's criticism when inherently it's necessary. So are there any coping strategies for handling honesty that you've used?
It's such a great question, Chris. It's one of the best questions I've ever gotten. To be honest with you, this is something us as a staff needs to continue to work on, because we have a couple of guys that don't handle the criticism very well. You know, if they're playing selfishly or if they're taking bad shots or, you know, whatever the circumstance is, and we address that, we see them sometimes shut down later on. And sometimes that adversity is positive. You know, it's not like when you're with your wife, you want to make sure that everything's good before you go to bed. If you get in a little argument, you know, kiss, make up, make sure everybody goes to bed, everything's good. Sometimes letting it hang over a player's head for a little while is a positive thing. So we don't rush to make them feel good after they've been criticized for certain players, certain actions. But there is a point where we need to help some kids get through it. And what we do is we try to play a good cop, bad cop with it. If my assistant coach, Coach Lavery, runs a lot of our defense, has been really hard on one of the student athletes, then I come back and I try to be really positive. And vice versa, if I've been hard, you know, him and the rest of the staff try to come back on. Also, we have a very expansive coaching staff. I have 4 assistant coaches, and then I have an additional 4 student assistant coaches. So, and we come from diverse backgrounds. So when needed, we will put a specific coach on a kid so he can sit there and talk with them daily, just little nuggets, come and go, get in his ear. Hey, this is what coach means. This is what you need to do. This is why it's successful. And then also we really try to emphasize positive reinforcement, Chris. It isn't just a grill session of what you're doing bad, but we talk about when you're doing great things too. And if we're trying to get a kid to step over and take a charge and he just won't do it, and finally he tries it in practice, and let's say he was moving, darn it, I'm calling a charge because that kid gave an effort. We haven't seen that yet. So there's the psychology behind it that we try to embrace, and every kid is different. And understanding where they come from, where their backgrounds are, where their motives are, I think that can help any coach manage their program at the highest level.
Well, and you already mentioned that it's not just telling them what they're doing wrong. You're obviously telling them how to do it right. And that's the other part, that it connects back to the fact that this is going to help them improve and the team be successful. So it's really good stuff. So, Coach, what does a typical game week look like for you in regards to scouting from preparation to application? Maybe start with, you know, the first part that you would do diving into preparing for an opponent.
So we always say there's about an average of 16 hours preparation for every opponent that we're about to play. So next week, we kick off conference play. We play Nebraska Kearney on Thursday, and then we play Fort Hays State on Saturday. We want our team focusing on Nebraska Kearney and not even thinking anything about Fort Hays State. So we're not presenting any information to our guys in Fort Hays State until Friday, which is a one-day prep for Fort Hays. However, our staff is putting together the Fort Hays scout in advance. So there's roughly 32 hours of prep work to prepare for both of those opponents. However, we will do things in practice that our players don't even know that will focus on the Fort Hays scout too. We're not talking about them, but for instance, if they're running a lot of ball screen, roll and replace, we will station that out. We will work on that in our shell just as common fundamental work. And then it'll help our short prep for Fort Hays, you know, which is just a one day. So on Monday, we will watch film and do a paper scout on Nebraska Kearney, our Thursday opponent. We will then go on the floor on Monday, and we'll focus primarily on our stuff. We won't focus that much on our opponent on Monday. We think that's a big time day to make ourselves better especially when we're multiple days away from our first or from our next opponent. On Tuesday, we will gear practice probably 50-50 towards improving ourselves and the other 50% in preparation for that Nebraska Kearney opponent on Thursday. A lot of up and down on both Monday and Tuesday. On Wednesday, we'll go at the exact same intensity level as we did on Monday and Tuesday, but we'll trim practice down about 15 minutes from about an hour and a half to an hour and 15 instead. And then instead of going north and south and up and down as much, most of our stuff will be geared in the half court. So we're just being cognitive of load management and wear and tear on our bodies, especially since we have three guys in our starting lineup that are creeping up towards that 30-minute night mark in a 40-minute college game, that we have to be cognitive of their wear and tear on their bodies, especially over the course of the entire college season. So again, Wednesday is probably 75% focused on Nebraska Kearney, 25% on us. And we play on Thursday, turn around on Friday. We have to present a lot of information to our guys in a short period of time. That's an interesting day, Chris, because it's the day after game and day before game at the same time. Some guys may have played 35 minutes that night. So, you can't just kill them. You need their bodies to have recovery. So a lot of stuff in the half court, probably less competitive, more walkthrough, but we still need to get blood flow, testosterone release. So there's recovery. And the day is almost exclusively focused on Fort Hays. We will also that day watch the Nebraska Kearney film that we had played on Thursday. Again, so you're looking at 2 hours of film there. You're looking at a film scout. That's another hour. So we're going to watch 3 hours of film on Friday so we can not only improve off of the mistakes that we made with our young team from the game before, but also prep for our next opponent the next day. So that's kind of what the week looks like. And it's very exhaustive. And that's why when we recruit kids, we let them know early on, this is a full-time job. And, we stay within the NCAA rules in terms of a number of hours we work with our guys, but we certainly get right to that limit every single week.
Yeah, I know it's an incredible investment of time and effort for everyone involved. And I'm curious, for you as a more experienced coach now, do you find you're more efficient with video? Because again, that tends to be this thing that as coaches, we have to say, oh, we watched, 10 games of our future opponent. But really, as you get better and more efficient with everything in life, that you need to spend less and less time to be able to pick out the things you do. Are you finding that for yourself as a more experienced coach?
Well, I think all the platforms and how we can work with synergy, and my assistants run a lot of it. They really are valuable in terms of getting information off to our guys. I would say we're more efficient in our presentation to our guys. I still really work, and I have young single assistant coaches who don't have families. And I really, really try to press upon them to take time away from the office and get away from the game and get other hobbies and other relationships. But part of having young single assistants also means that these guys are so professionally driven that a coach and as their mentor, it's important for me to press upon them that less is sometimes more. We certainly do that in presentation fashion with our guys, but But again, I still think our staff needs to continue to work on getting away from the game a little bit. You know, if it's not helping you win games, maybe, you know, go do something else. You'll be more focused the next time. You know, I have a family. I have two kids. My wife is pregnant right now, and I've worked really hard on being efficient with my time and being able to be a family man and a coach. So I think that's important. And then, of course, with our student athletes, it's important that we can, number one, stay within the 20 hours a week time frame. But at the same time, too, understand that they need to have a social life at the college level. They need to have a college experience, too. And all that is very valuable. So, yes, I think we're getting more efficient in our presentation, but we can get more efficient as a staff in terms of managing our own schedules, I think.
I imagine you deal with this since, again, a lot of your stuff is geared towards young coaches and helping them. And it's great stuff for them. But I get asked a lot about that work-life balance. Is there anything that you've found that as you've experimented with different things to be more the most effective way to be able to help you with work-life balance? Some practical things?
Well, Tom wants divorce. So when I got the job at Central Wyoming College as an assistant, our recruiting base, the closest one was Salt Lake City, is 4.5 hours, and Denver is 6 hours away. So I was on the road constantly. Our closest game was 2 hours away, and it's a bus league. Our closest game was a 2-hour bus ride, and our average is about 5.5. So I was on the road all the time. When I got home, I wasn't present because I was young. I was trying to get my foot in the door to the industry. So I was just constantly texting, recruiting all the time. So I rarely was home. When I was home, I wasn't present. So and that just didn't work out. I mean, my wife said that, you know, I'm not doing this anymore. And we ultimately got a divorce, and I'm remarried. I've learned from those mistakes. I focus on when I am home that I am present. That doesn't mean that I'm not available because my phone is available, but I try to really put that thing down for at least an hour every night and just play with my 16-month-old daughter. And my 10-year-old son, we try to go out and play catch with the football. And you know, he's got so many different interests in history and even video games. He likes to play Madden. So I try to go in there and maybe play a game of Madden with him once a week, just so I'm doing things that he likes and that we're interacting with one another. And for me, it was adversity that caused me to change. And I'm also married now to a former college athlete who played both volleyball and softball. So she has an understanding. She gets it. She understands the busy season. But I think that goes hand in hand with compatibility. I think it also goes hand in hand with communication, talking things through, being present, being loyal. These things are all really, really important, especially if you have a family. And if you don't have a family and want a family, you're going to have to figure out work-life balance too, because if you're in the office for 15 hours a day, you're not going to meet very many people.
Coming back to Scout Report, how specific does practice get towards the scout? And like, do you use a scout team? Do all players need to learn on the court what the other team does? What does that look like in terms of your preparation and your scout?
We've done it multiple ways, Chris. We have, at times, certain years, I have made our starting lineup, our projected lineup for that night, be the scout team. Because if you know how to run their stuff, you can also guard their stuff as well. And they would flip. So you would run the stuff, and then we would flip the next five guys, but they'd try to run it. The problem I have with that is it's so tough to play with proper pace from what the other team is going to do. If you're trying to run it and then you're trying to guard it and the other team gets short and full. So right now, kind of what we like to do is get our scout team down there early. They watch the film. They go down there with one of the assistant coaches who has that respective scouting report. And they go through the opponent's action. And they really try to play it with pace, because if you're just walking through what the opponent's going to do, and then all of a sudden come game time, you know the action, but they're going full speed, playing with pace, it's going to punch you in the mouth, and you're going to struggle guarding that. So it's important for us, and this year I've changed a little bit with having our scout go early and really having them station it out and work on the other team stuff and really trying to master the other team's stuff, and then we guard it. What I like to do is, in practice, we will go up and down four possessions. We'll go down, run a set. I'll give our team the two actions I want them to run. They'll go down an offense. Then they run our set. They retreat back on defense. They have to guard our opponent's stuff. They go back on offense, another offensive set for us, and they come back, and they're right against the scout team the whole time. So they also have to transition thought from running our stuff to then turning around and guarding their stuff,
which I think is most game simulated.
Other than video, what are some things you're doing to deliver the information to the players? And are you delivering it, or are they writing it down? Are they note-taking? What are some things that you're doing other than video and on court, as you just said?
So I may be in the minority here, but I am anti-note-taking. And I'm not a pen and paper guy at all. I personally didn't learn very well with that method. I never took notes in classes. I internalized information when I was engaged in the process, when I was thinking it through, and I wasn't looking down, taking notes, and then not listening to the next concepts that was being presented. Because as you're writing things down, and whether it's your professor or whether it's your coach is still talking, then you're missing other data points. So for us, you know, we're going to run 40-man sets before it's all said and done this year. You know, we have mostly a new team this year, so we came in with none, and we have to build it all up. And we're sitting at about 18 sets right now. We'll end with 40, and nobody will get a playbook. Nobody will get any information. We show film constantly for it, and for us, it's all about putting their bodies through the action. So I also don't think paper shows timing and spacing the way that film does, and in the way that putting their bodies through it does. And again, that's why I think your Twitter handle is and what you've been able to create, Chris, is so valuable, because you show that, you break it down, you stop with writing on the film, and you show why the cuts work and where they're at. And your teaching methods is exactly how we try to teach our guys, versus handing them a playbook and having them look at it. I just don't think that shows the timing at the level that it's needed, and guys don't internalize it the same. So really the only time we give them paper is during the film scout. They will get a paper scout as well. The paper scout includes photos, the roster photos of each of the starters, and then usually the best three or four, the top three or four guys off the bench is what we like to present. We don't like to present more 8 or 9 guys, even if a team has an 11-man rotation. Our staff needs to know those guys for if they get checked into the game, but from an internalization standpoint, our guys there's only so much information you want to present to them. So that's the only paper presentation we give them. Everything else is through film and through actions on the court.
Well, I'm very much aligned with that. So I'm happy someone said that as well, because I always found all the other stuff took a lot of valuable time away from me being more efficient too and producing all this paper and all these documents, all these different things. So, and shout out to ClipDraw. ClipDraw is what helps me do what I do in terms of those video edits. But that's exactly, I mean, what you see me do with those video edits is what I would share with my players. They would get those. We had a private Facebook group where I'd share those edits of our opponents, so they could watch it as much as they wanted if they needed to watch it more. But my main focus was exactly what you said, which is do it on the court. Do it on the court. I mean, there's nothing more valuable.
Absolutely. I mean, it's the same thing comes down. You know, if I'm drawing up plays that I haven't put, I mean, we just don't do that. Like, we're not going to draw up some magical set or magical action to try to win the game or to, you know, we need a bucket here. No, it's the coaches. So you barely, the only thing you're showing on that clipboard is what you've already gone through, hopefully hundreds of times, you know, through film and through putting their bodies on the court and having them go through it. Maybe a minor tweak here or there, but for the most part, you know, what you're showing is just to reiterate what you've already done, because if you've done your job as a coach, you've already put their bodies through it constantly.
Do you care about opponent play calls? Is that something you guys try and figure out, or do you just go based on you've already defended those actions so many times in practice, is just what you call them?
No, we rely on opponent play calls. We love to get their verbals. If we can't get their call, we'll make up our own call for it. Just, you know, what it doesn't matter what you call it, as long as you guys speak the same language and you guys know what's coming. We try to prepare for that action as best as possible. Our league is so highly scouted, most for American college basketball, especially to the NCAA Division II level, which we are, most leagues and most teams, I would say probably 70 to 80% only have one full-time assistant. Our league is loaded. Most every team has two full-time assistants. They have graduate assistants, student assistants. So every team is so heavily prepared for you because they have so many coaches working on it and getting that information and data and presenting it over. You know, we recycle a lot of our stuff too, Chris. Some of the actions that's going to work early on won't work, so we shut it down for 5-6 games, and then we come back to it again later on. And that's why we have so many different play calls. We'll go back and forth on it, but from an opponent scouting standpoint, we want to be able to guard their best five action. That's kind of where we're at, is what is their best five that they're utilizing the most and that they're most effective at running
we need to be able to shut those down so they're running their secondary stuff way more often than what their, you know, what their bread and butter is.
And with that, you know, by the way, I got to mention this because I hope coaches caught that. Make up your own call for it. You don't need to know the opponent's specific call. If you just, your players know what the call is when they identify it. And that's awesome. I love that. And I think more coaches should think about that in terms of, hey, if you don't have their call, it doesn't matter. That's not the be all and end all. It's whether your players can identify it. So
you're exactly right, though, because as a coaching staff, you're seeing the action. You're seeing, you know, whether they're getting into a horn set or you know, most of these actions have triggers. And it doesn't matter if your whole staff knows what the trigger is. It matters if your players know. So if you can see that initial trigger and you give the verbal, even if it's not their verbal, you give the verbal that you've taught your guys to know, then they can be prepared for that cross screen, downstream, or whatever the action is going to be. No, you're exactly right.
Jumping into practice, coach, because you mentioned this, and I believe I can probably post a link a little bit later, but you posted an example of one of the charts that you stat and chart many things in practice, obviously. But let's talk specifically a little bit more about some of the things that are most valuable for your players. What are some of the things that they value most from that in terms of you statting and charting things in practice?
Well, I hope they value what we value as a staff and as a program. And that's again, why we start out running the program. We slowly give it to them, because if they value what we're trying to build this around, then we're all going to be successful later on. And we've recruited a team that should be really, really good on the boards. And when we won our national championship at Graceland in 2018 at Graceland University, we were plus 10 average on the glass per game. And we played 39 games that season. That's 390 more rebounds than our opponent over a season. And talk about creating margin for error for when, you know, your shots aren't going in and when you're maybe making mistakes elsewhere. If you can dominate the glass like that, you know, there's some really good things that can come out of that. So I hope our guys value, and we press upon them to value, how many rebounds are you getting per practice? You know, it matters if you're ball chasing. It matters if you're securing box outs and then going and getting a ball, as opposed to just rebounding in your own zone when the ball's coming to you. We chart blow bys. Are we keeping the ball in front of us? Are you as an individual player keeping the ball in front of you? Can you close out and then big step and keep the ball in front? These are things that we value, because we feel a good defensive team will step over on help side, but we feel a great defensive team will be able to close out and keep the basketball in front of them, so help doesn't have to come over. And again, there's data to show if they are rebounding or if they're keeping the ball in front. Of course, everyone's going to look at field goal percentage and 3-point percentage, and they're going to look at that because I think every player naturally is going to, I'd look at that too as a player back in the day, Chris, if they would have charted. But we try to really impress upon them that, much like the plus minus in the box score during the games, you know, we had a kid that went 1-for-3 the other night, but he was plus 22 and didn't make much of an impact offensively, but he was our second leading rebounder in the game. He had 8 rebounds, and he defended incredibly well. When he was in the game for his 22 minutes, we were plus 22. So he was plus 1 per minute that he played, and yet he didn't score the basketball. And again, we try to emphasize that as a huge benefit to how he's impacting winning, and try to showcase that to everybody. So again, I hope our guys find value in what we find value in, because we feel it's going to correlate over to wins.
Such a great point. And coach, I know everyone's going to ask now, how do you build such a great rebounding team? What are some of the things that have led to success? I mean, number one is obviously emphasis, because you're charting it every day and you're valuing it every day, but are you doing rebound specific drills, or is it just an emphasis within all the things that you do?
Well, in American college basketball, you can recruit to what you want to build your program on. So we recruited size this year and a ton of it. I mean, we have the ability to roll out a lineup that's 5'10", that's 6'6", 6'8", 6'8", and 6'9". We have the ability to roll that lineup out and hopefully just dominate on the glass. And so again, we can recruit to it. One, if a coach doesn't have that ability to recruit to it, because whether they're a high school coach or whether their program's just kind of intact as it is, I think emphasizing is the number one thing. And that goes with not only charting and being able to present that data to your guys, but also teaching technique in terms of how to check out, teaching technique on offensive rebounding. A lot of coaches, I think yell go rebound, but are you teaching your guys to take the first step after that shot is released? on the weak side, because you're going to get the offensive rebound oftentimes if you've beaten your man to your original spot. Are you teaching box outs and spin ceiling? Are you emphasizing rebounding with two hands? You know, we make our guys run every time they go up and grab a ball one-handed and pull it into the other hand. Because, and again, I know come game time, maybe your arm will be held, have to do that. But we try to get the junk out of their game. It maybe looks cool to grab it and pop it into the other hand, but also, you know, we're watching a game last night and we're watching Creighton play against, we're watching Creighton play against San Diego State on TV. And I see one of the guys, Creighton, go up to grab a rebound, pop it to his other hand, lose control of it. San Diego guy picks it up, makes a layup. And so what I do is, of course, you know, this is the era we live in, Chris. I rewind it on my DVR. I videotape it and I send it in a group text to everybody. And I said, what was wrong here? And they all came back almost simultaneously. He tried to rebound with one hand. So we're getting through to them, right? They saw what happened.
Absolutely.
They saw the adverse reaction to it. But again, we emphasize, we drill it, and we recruit to it. That's how we become a good rebounding team.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I know you talked, too, about you know, some things that you can't chart as much. But I'm not sure if you do some things to measure it or not. And that's the question. But stats such as leadership, body language, toughness, defensive positioning, are there some things that you've found that – represent those things best in terms of this competitive practice charting?
Not in charting. We emphasize verbally through it. I mean, if we have a guy that maybe struggles, and players are going to look at field goal percentage, rebounds, and say, well, I should be playing, coach. I'm doing these things better than the guy at my position, and he's getting as much playing time as I am. So you have to sell that a little bit in practice and explain why. I mean, at the end of the day, coaches don't really care who plays. They shouldn't care who plays. They should play those who give them the best opportunity to win. And of course, depth matters too. And being able to develop young talent all matters. But if we have a great defensive player, it's not necessarily charted, but when we're doing shell, we can say, Hey Dallas, that's a big time closeout right there. And that's why we love you in the game, lighten it, because we trust you're going to make that happen. And when we verbalize those things, I think it could be more effective than even charting, because not only can it justify why you're maybe playing that kid late in the game, but also you'll see improvement from the student athlete who he's playing over top of. So again, charting is important. Data is important, but also being able to connect with those guys on a non-analytical standpoint and just connect with them on a man-to-man level and say, hey, this is why it's happening and it's positive, and this is why it's happening maybe and it's negative. I think there's great value in that too.
You talked about some of the player-led concepts within your program, and one being obviously freedom for the offensive player as they move along within the season. But is that also inherent to certain players on your roster? In watching some of your film, it looked like obviously you were trying to create some great spacing for certain players to be able to attack in ISO in those situations. Is that something that's always been within your program as well?
So I assumed you had watched some film on us, Chris, because you're the film connoisseur, and that's why another reason I have mad respect for you. We won that 2018 national championship game at Grace, and we ran a set every single time down to Florida. And we tell our guys, hey, if you don't want to run a set, get a stop, extend the outlet, run out in primary. Let's get out and go, or force a turnover. Let's get out and go. In the half court, we certainly try to put our guys in strength positions, and that means getting the ball in the hands of our guys who are talented scorers, but also so they have space. You know, the other thing I think, which is really underrated, is using some of your best players as decoys, using some of your best players as screeners, because that creates opportunities for others. So we constantly toy and play with defenses. When we see a team that hard hedges outward, we try to play with that hedge all night long just to soften it up, because if they're a good hedging team, they're relying on that hedge. And then if you can soften it up and get throwback entries and you can get clear out, roll and hit actions for layups, and all of a sudden you're softer than the heads. Now it's going to create action for your point guard getting downhill because the guy's no longer hedging as hard. So again, we, as a staff, study film. And when we're studying that, we're not only looking at what they're going to do, but me as an offensive coach, and I highly study what the defense is doing, how we can pick it apart. And if we can gain 8-10 points advantage off doing that, that could be the difference in a win and a loss. But it all comes down to creating spacing and creating strength positions and opportunities for your best players to make plays.
Well, I enjoyed watching the film. I mean, I'll be honest, I hadn't watched a lot. I mean, I knew of your success, and watching back to the Graceland years and then obviously Imperial, where you're just trying to build it now. Are you following the same script, or do you have to change the script a little bit relative to the talent, relative to the recruitment base? How are you approaching this in terms of, let's say, style of play on offense?
It's a great question, Chris. Here's kind of my thoughts on that. And I've verbalized this to a few people already. You know, when I was a junior college coach and even an NAI coach, I felt like as a coach, I could almost create the action to score between 16 and 30 points a game, like almost create the entire basket. As we've moved up now at the Division II level, the defenses are so good. The preparation is so good. You can't create the basket anymore, but you can create the opportunity and you can create the spacing. So it's changed a little bit because of levels. It's such a player's game, especially as you go up in levels and go up in talent, that sometimes you just need to get the heck out of their way a little bit. You got to simplify. I think I've simplified. Well, we came in this year and we had if and statements. If we're running a flat ball screen, secondary break, and if he went left, there was a hard roll and replace. And if he went right, it was a come together screen and back cut on the weak side. And I just felt like we got way too complex, especially for a new team. So after about 4 weeks of wasting everybody's time working on that, I said, you know, I'm not doing a good enough job. I've got to simplify this in the way that I have in the past, to allow our players to play more free, to allow our players to cut things off and to create better actions. Oh, just to get them thinking less and playing more. So we scrapped a lot of that stuff. We went back to what we were doing and, you know, in the Graceland years, which was just 2 years ago. And we're finding good success out of it. We study a lot of NBA stuff. You get a lot of arc flip actions where the guy, you know, guard on guard screens where he's coming up and he's acting like he's going to screen and he slips to the arc and doesn't even set the screen just for confusion on the basketball. You know, there's different things we can do to help our point guards get downhill early and just create space for him. So, you know, we are changing. I think you always have to change. Coach K's national championship teams at Duke in the early 90s look completely different than his most recent national championship team. And I think that's a credit to him, you know, coaching Team USA and continuing to study and surround himself by people that aren't stuck in the times. And that's the only way you're going to continue to find success. You know, it's tough for me, Chris, to watch clips of MJ. And he was so good in the mid-range. There was never space for him to drive. I mean, everybody was just literally on top of each other. The spacing in the NBA in the 90s was so bad. I can't imagine how effective he would be today. So again, it's an ever-evolving game. And it doesn't matter what level you're at. I just think you should study all levels. You should be a student of the game. You should always be evolving. Otherwise, you'll get left behind.
There's no doubt about that. And that's such an intriguing thing. And I obviously, I don't like getting into generational debates, but the game's different. I mean, it's just different now. And, you know, and some coaches who are slow to adapt to that are certainly finding out how challenging it is to coach in the modern game if you're not adapting. So such a great example of that for you. And the other thing that I saw as a tweet, and I saved this a while back, but it was this concept of valuing the same things as your boss, which probably is something we don't talk enough about on here, is this notion that, you know, no matter what, you got to make it seem like you're aligned with your boss, right? Can you talk about that a little bit in terms of the different jobs that you've had and then the value of that?
Yeah, and I think you can look at that in many different lights, because as a player, you know, we try to make our players be a part, you know, our program be a partnership where it's not, you know, you answer to some authoritarian leader who's the end all be all. We try to make it a partnership where, yes, but at the end of the day, you do know who's in charge. And as a player, you have to value the same things that your coach does, or you're not going to find the individual or team success that you want to have. As an assistant coach, you have to value the things that your boss is, but at the same time, it's a fine line. You don't want to be a yes man. You want to be able to challenge, you know, at the right time in closed doors meetings, and you want to be able to create some autonomy for yourself to add the most value to the program. But you can't, if your boss is a defensive guy that likes to slow down tempo, and that's just kind of his MO, that's who he is, and you come in there and you're trying to pick the pace up and you value completely different things, that's not going to work out. You know, that's just a contrast of styles that's not going to work in harmony with one another. For me as a head coach, I answer to an athletic director. My athletic director is Kent Weiser, is one of the best humans on this planet. He was associate athletic director at Oregon State prior to coming to Emporia State 20 years ago.
He hired me after we won that 2018 NAI National Championship at Grayson. He hired me here at Emporia State. And he's an awesome human being. And you should probably say that whether your boss is awesome or not, especially on a podcast. But my guy, he really is awesome. And he just kind of lets us operate and he believes in us. But what's really important to him is that I get in front of different people, different members in the community, whether they're boosters or whether they're just friends of the college. And it's really important for him that I'm visible in the public. So if I'm an introvert, which I'm not, but if I was, I would have to figure out a way to value that, because that's important. That's one of the things that's really important to him, is that I get out in front of the public eye and I build a relationship with people in our community. That comes easy for me. I love that. But the point is that, let's say his thing, if it was really important to him that I did all my own receipts and budgeting and I present this data in a way that's going to take up, you know, 10 hours of my time every month to turn into the business office. If he was a stickler on that, because I hate that stuff, Chris. If he was
too.
A stickler on that, guess what? Well, I mean, it's important to be able to balance budgets, but to cut up receipts and to put them in a certain way and to write different allocations. If he was really stickler on that, it's important for me to change, because he's my boss. I need to value that. And again, I think that's why basketball is so valuable. I mean, whether it's for your staff, whether it's for your players, when you're no longer around sport, this stuff is important, whether you're working on Wall Street or whether you're working anywhere. Even if you are the CEO of a company, you answer to your shareholders. So you're always going to answer to people. What is important to them? And if you can value that and you can work in harmony there, boy, your life experience professionally is going to be that much better.
Here, here. So great stuff throughout, Coach. Thanks for taking the time and sharing with us. I mean, I've really enjoyed getting to know you through social media. And now I know so many people enjoy getting to know you on this podcast as well. And look forward to following your program as you build it there as well. So thanks for taking the time.
Chris, I appreciate you. Myself, so many coaches throughout the United States and beyond, we're just so grateful for what you're doing for the game of basketball. Keep up the great work. You got a lot of respect coming from our way, man. Thank you.
I appreciate that. Thanks, Coach. To find out more about Coach and all we spoke about today, please take a look at the show notes for today's episode. I love to share the game and have basketball coaching conversations, so connect with me on social media. You can find all my social media information and all your membership, clinic, and consulting needs at basketballimmersion.com. That concludes today's episode. I know there are so many podcasts out there. Thank you for taking the time to listen to the Basketball Podcast with me, your host, Chris Oliver. Please subscribe and share the podcast with your friends and colleagues so that we can keep bringing you the best of what's out there and share the game.